dog is quick.
A scientist in Boston has been driving around the city measuring leaks in gas mains, and he's found a lot. Gas leaks are not uncommon, and gas companies spend a lot of time tracking them down and repairing them. But the scientific team says they are surprised at how many they've found and what those leaks are doing to the health of the city's trees. NPR's Christopher Joyce has more.
Biologist Nathan Phillips at Boston University was intrigued with what methane from underground gas mains might be doing to trees. On a stroll through Boston, he met a former gas line inspector who said Boston's gas system was, in fact, leaky. So Phillips obtained a methane detector called a cavity ring down spectrometer and put it in a car.
We just measure while we drive. It's a very fast-acting piece of equipment.
Together, the team drove 785 miles of Boston and suburban roads. They found about 4,000 significant leaks.
Like many people, I really didn't know the scope of the problem, so I was very surprised.
In some cases, the levels were high.
The record level that we found for a leak, this is in the atmosphere that we breathe on the surface in Boston, was about 30 parts per million of methane, and that's over 15 times the normal background level.
Phillips notes that he's not a health expert and says he has no reason to believe these levels pose a risk to human health, but he does believe, as a plant physiologist, that the methane is probably harming trees.
Natural gas is largely methane. That displaces the oxygen. It's also dry gas, so it desiccates the soils as well. And roots need to have oxygen for the metabolism of the roots, for the repair of the root membranes. If they're starved for oxygen, the tree will suffer.
A state advocacy group is suing utilities in the region for damages to trees and citing Phillips' research. The plaintiffs are communities that claim millions of dollars of damage has been done to trees in the Boston area. Tom Kiley, head of the Northeast Gas Association, says it's true that methane can damage vegetation, but it's not common.
There certainly are a lot of potential causes to the damage to trees and vegetation that include insect infestation, vehicular damage, disease, storm damage, drought, salt, waste oil, gasoline.
The association represents gas companies in the region. Kylie says when there's damage, gas companies remove and replace the trees. That's confirmed by a spokesman for National Grid, the major supplier of natural gas to the Boston area. As for the leaks, Kylie says gas companies do report how much they lose statewide to the State Department of Public Utilities. He doesn't know how many leaks there are in Boston, but says leaks are a problem that the companies take seriously.
It's an older system. It is being replaced. There are some cast iron facilities and some bare steel or unprotected steel that are being replaced. So there are, in fact, leaks on the joints.
For his part, Nathan Phillips says he recognizes that the gas company is working to contain leaks. His aim, he says, is to make the information about the leak's whereabouts and frequency easily available to the public.
The buried infrastructure, when it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and it's easy for us to just forget that it even exists.
Phillips notes methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas that warms the planet. And in fact, scientists at the company that makes the methane sniffer, Picaro, in California, have begun mapping leaks in San Francisco, too. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
More than 300 million people travel every year for religious purposes. Many are making pilgrimages to holy cities and sacred sites. But when so many people travel, they can endanger the very places they love. Authorities of some pilgrimage destinations want to reduce the pollution and environmental damage caused by so many people. They're joining what's called the Green Pilgrimage Movement. That includes the Indian holy city of Amritsar, where we found NPR's Corey Flintoff.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, and the courtyard of the Golden Temple is already pulsing with life. Thousands of Sikh pilgrims pray and sing as they wait for the daily ritual in which the holy book, the Guru Granth Sahib, is carried to the sanctuary. The gold-sheathed temple is strung with lights, so it gleams like a jewel box in the midst of a mirror-like pond. The book, covered in rich cloth, is placed in a litter under a golden canopy and carried across a causeway, followed by devotees. Most of the men wear the carefully wrapped turbans and the uncut beards that are the most familiar marks of their religion. Sikhs from all over India and the world stay in touch with their faith by visiting this and other holy sites as often as they can.
Everyone has to be here like once a year, twice a year. Like people come from all over the world, wherever we have Sikh communities, they come back to India, and the one place that they surely will go to is the Golden Temple.
This is Ravneet Pal Singh, who works for the environmental group EcoSikh. He says the city of Amritsar gets around 100,000 visitors a day, pilgrims and tourists, and three times that many on holidays.
They come here, drink a lot of water, and use public transport and all those facilities that you have to use while you're in a travel to such a place. So we can change many things and reduce carbon footprint a lot.
Singh is particularly fired up because he's just returned from a meeting of other representatives of the Green Pilgrim Cities Network in Assisi, Italy. He was part of a small delegation of city and temple officials who pledged to try to incorporate environmentally friendly practices in Amritsar. Singh says the ideas for Amritsar include solar panels for the lighting system that keeps the temple gleaming throughout the night. Other plans revolve around a core tenet of the Sikh religion, that believers provide food for anyone who wants it. At the Golden Temple's communal kitchen, volunteers prepare and serve around 85,000 meals each day. Singh is proud that the meals are served on stainless steel plates and bowls, so there's no plastic waste. But he says the temple wants to extend green practices to the cooking and cleaning. He says the temple wants to install solar water heaters for this area, where steel dishes clash like cymbals as hundreds of volunteers wash up. Temple authorities also want to make better use of the water.
All the temples here, whether they are Hindu temples or Sikh temples or Muslim mosque or church, they should have rainwater harvesting, and as far as possible, they should have solar panels.
Singh says the organizers hope to educate pilgrims by reminding them of the earth-friendly messages that are already part of Sikh theology.
The air is our master. Water is our father. And this earth is our great-great mother. So this is direct relation that the masters, Sikh masters, have given to us. And we should now reflect the way they taught us.
Singh says the Green Pilgrim Cities Network estimates that around 40% of the world's people make religious pilgrimages at some time in their lives. Singh says that's a lot of people who are potentially ripe for earth-friendly messages. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, New Delhi.
Let's talk about a different number now, one the Obama administration hopes to make a reality. Under rules announced by the White House this summer, cars will have to get an average of 55 miles a gallon by 2025. That's nearly twice what the current average is. Reaching that goal will take feats of engineering, and it will require Americans to change how they think about their cars and how they drive them. In the first of a series of stories, NPR's Sonari Glinton looks at how the auto industry plans to get to 55.
It's one of the ways carmakers expect to lower their average fuel consumption. The problem is, people aren't buying, whether it's all-electric or plug-in hybrid. The Chevy Volt is struggling to sell 10,000 cars this year. Nissan has sold just over 8,000 Leafs. To give you some context, about 13 million cars are expected to be sold this year in the U.S. Brian Brockman is with Nissan. He took me on a test drive of their all-new electric Leaf.
All right, how do I know it's on? Oh, Diane Rehm. Oh, look at you.
Okay, so when you start the vehicle up, obviously you don't have a gas engine under the hood here, so you don't have what you typically think of as a startup sound, which is that engine turning over.
Not only is it quiet, it's also smart. Yes. It looks genuinely space-aged. It doesn't fly, but Nissan claims the car gets about 100 miles per charge. Sort of.
Physics naturally takes over even with these cars. If you go a lot faster, say you're going 80 miles an hour on the highway, you will naturally get more resistance against the car. The car has to work a little bit harder, so the range is going to go down a little bit faster.
So what Brockman doesn't say is you're only going to get that 100-mile range on a cool spring day, doing about 40 miles an hour when you're not using the AC and the car is going downhill. Consumer Reports tested the Leaf. They say it gets an average of about 65 miles on the charge.
So shut the car off with the button.
Speaking of charging, we drove over to a charging station.
So basically you just tap that, it'll unlock the plug, and then you just plug it into the car.
This charging station is at the local power company near Detroit. Problem is, there aren't enough places yet to go get your car charged. And right now, it can take up to 16 hours, depending on what kind of outlet you use. The other problem, what car people call range anxiety.
That feeling in your stomach starts to set in like, oh no, what if I can't make it? And that's part of the problem.
Brian Moody is with the car website autotrader.com.
People feel like they don't have a grasp on how it works and what the range is. It's sort of like a microwave oven. You know what it does, but you don't know exactly how it does it. It works by magic, and people don't like that.
Once people actually find out about the cars, they like them even less. Craig Giffey is with Deloitte. He recently conducted a study about what people around the world think about electric cars. Giffey says people like the idea of electric cars. That's the good news.
The bad news is that the technology is currently at a point where they have to make trade-offs. So they want that same vehicle. They want it to look and feel the same. They also want it to perform the same, which means they want it to go as far. They want to be able to refuel it, or in this case, recharge it quickly.
Nobody's expecting those changes to happen anytime soon. Again, Brian Moody with autotrader.com.
The problem is the chances of there being a 500-mile range electric car, at this point, it seems pretty unlikely. Because you can go to the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan and see electric cars. To me, that's not great progress.
My name is Bob Casey, and I'm the Senior Curator of Transportation at the Henry Ford.
Casey took me on the tour of the Henry Ford Car Museum in Dearborn, Michigan.
This, by the way, this electric car was Clara Ford's. Henry's wife drove an electric car.
Like today, electric cars in Clara Ford's day couldn't do what gas-powered cars could, so electric car makers had to turn to niche markets.
And one place where there was a demand for electric cars was among well-to-do urban women. They're quiet, they're clean. If you're living in a city, you don't have to go very far. If you're wealthy, you can install a charger in your home or in your garage. And if you're wealthy, you can afford these things because they were expensive.
Not that much has changed with electric cars in more than 100 years. Casey says if they're to be widely adopted, it's drivers themselves and their habits that will need to change. Sonari Glenton, NPR News.